problem of misdropped supplies. With the loss of control of the southern airstrip late in March, the only available drop zones left were those directly on the pitifully small target of the main strongpoints of Isabel. A cargo aircraft, even flying at stalling speed, would cross all of Isabel in about 2 seconds. Hence, even the tiniest navigational error, and they were numerous and excusable as the pilots entered the flak gauntlet over the valley, meant that the supplies would fall outside the perimeter and be lost to the enemy. In the case of Isabel, this meant that the last warm food was eaten by all hands on April 19th, and that the whole garrison completely ran out of food on April 20th in the evening, with the exception of the severely wounded, who were put on minimal rations. At 1400 that afternoon, Lalande laconically reported his situation as follows. 2-1 RTA, 490. 3-3 REI, 400. Ties, 370. 5-7 RTA, etc., 140. Total, 1,400. The Strongpoint's small hospital now also housed 117 severe hospital cases that no longer could be evacuated to the main hospitals in Dien Bien Phu, let alone picked up by aircraft. Another 136 men had died in combat or were missing. The artillery still had 8 howitzers, and 2 of the 3 M24 tanks were still operational. In other words, the overall casualty rate was around 15%. That, along with the constant artillery bombardment and the starvation of the last days, was bound to bring about a crisis. It broke out on April 26th. On that day, Lalande had given Jean Sel the order to pick 4 of his best platoons for a counterattack against the communist approach trenches northeast of Strongpoint Wien. According to intelligence, the counterattack would involve the crossing of only 1 enemy trench. As it turned out, there were 2 enemy trenches, one behind the other, and the Algerians' attack ran into trouble on April 18th to 19th. What saved the Algerians from total destruction was that Lieutenant Préau threw his 2 remaining bisons into the fight and covered the withdrawal of the Algerians back to Isabel IV. The small company had lost 6 dead and 22 wounded in the fight. What happened next remains difficult to reconstruct to this day, as almost all the participants are highly reluctant to tell the whole story. Upon the return of the Algerian force to the main position, Colonel Lalande felt that an example had to be set after this second unsuccessful attack in 1 week, lest the other units be demoralized, and he decided to use a harsh last resort measure only rarely employed in any army: execution for cowardice. Courts-martial for cowardice are extremely rare. Throughout all of World War II, the United States Army executed only 1 man, a Private Slobik, in connection with such a charge. During the Korean War, there seems to have been only 1 such trial, and the defendant was allowed to plead to a lesser charge. In France, a large-scale mutiny of frontline troops in 1917 was severely dealt with, and at least 1 unit was decimated, in the literal sense of the word. That is, every 10th man was executed as an example, regardless of his own individual guilt. Lalande now decided to apply this ancient iron law to the company that had failed, and ordered the platoon commanders to designate on their own 2 men each to be shot before a firing squad at 1800 that evening. In the 2-1 Algerian Rifles, there was a company commander of Algerian nationality, Lieutenant Cheikh Belabich, of 8th Company. He had not participated in the day's unfortunate operation, but one of his platoons had, and the bearded Algerian master sergeant, an old-time regular with 14 citations for bravery, came to see him after the news of the punishment had spread. "Lieutenant," said the sergeant, "I am not going to designate 2 guys from our platoon to be shot. We were all equally brave, and we all tried just as hard. They can either shoot us all, or they better not shoot anybody." Belabich first called Captain Gendre to check the news. Gendre had learned about it also, and thought that someone had gone nuts. Soon thereafter, Jean Sonnel talked to Belabich over the telephone and reviewed with him the aborted attack. Jean Sonnel felt that, considering the mistake made by intelligence, the operation had gone as well as could be expected, but when Belabich then objected that the drastic punishment that was about to be meted out was therefore not called for, Jean Sonnel simply replied, "The colonel has made his decision. I can only approve him." "Captain," said Belabich, "have you foreseen the consequences of this? I know the Algerian tirailleurs better than you do, Lieutenant, and I know how to keep them on the leash." Then Belabich lost control of himself. "Listen, Captain, The tirailleurs are standing right here with drawn submachine guns. If you wish to get them, this will end up in us shooting at each other, and the Viets will end up getting what's left. Think that one over. Thereupon, Bellerive decided to go and see Lalande himself. At first, Lalande insisted upon carrying out the punishment as decided. But then, Bellerive told him bluntly that when his own French legionnaires had failed to break through, and in fact had run like rabbits, nobody had been sent to the firing squad. None of the Algerians would ever understand why two different standards of judgment should be applied to the same act. Lalande calmed the young officer, and finally Bellerive said softly, "Do you think, mon colonel, that we can afford to throw away the few troops we've got? I have received exactly one man in airdropped reinforcements for the 60 we have lost." Lalande thought it over, and then found a solution to the dilemma. He felt that he could not entirely back down without giving in to troops who were on the verge of mutiny, even though the situation might well have been created by his own action. He thereupon told Bellerive to return to the Algerian riflemen and tell them that a trial would be held, but that the men would be acquitted. With that assurance in hand, Bellerive returned to his troops. And that evening, indeed, the fantastic scene took place. A formal court-martial had been convened, with three captains and three lieutenants in one of the dugouts. The bewildered Algerian riflemen who had been selected for the trial stood in front of the board with their appointed defense counsel, a French officer from another battalion in the position. With communist artillery shells bursting overhead, in the bleak light of a bare electric light bulb dangling from a wire affixed to the roof of the dugout, the prosecutor presented his charges, the counsel for the riflemen presented his defense, and the jury briefly left the room to deliberate. It duly returned a verdict of not guilty, and the riflemen, just as bewildered as before, and barely comprehending what the whole ceremonial had been about, returned in the midst of the artillery barrage to their own dugouts. Bellerive heaved a sigh of relief, and as he returned to his own CP, he met Jeansonel, who told him that his Legion of Honor, for which he had been proposed weeks ago, had finally been approved. Bellerive thanked him, and then added, "I am glad to have it, but I really earned it just a few hours ago." That evening, the Castries sent a personal telegram to General Cogny, in which the events of the day on Issevel were not mentioned directly. In fact, it is doubtful that Lalande had reported them to de Castries at that time. But the telegram contained the following telling passage. "Issevel reports very strong lowering of morale among North African troops. They request that they also should be mentioned in the dispatches." With the rains now falling, most of Issevel became a swamp, and Strongpoint Weem in particular became little else but a knee-deep quagmire. A counterattack by Legionnaires and Thai on April 27th to eliminate the Viet Minh penetration in the northeast corner of Weem failed just as miserably as had the attack by the Algerians on the previous day. And with the main position at Dien Bien Phu now facing its agony, there was little artillery support now available on Claudine, the howitzers of Issevel itself being far too close to fire effective support, to help Issevel in its own predicament. Thursday, April 29th, 1954. At 22:25, a new threat developed against sorely tried Weem, when suddenly several powerful 75mm recoilless rifles appeared in the communist forward trenches, coupled with murderous 105mm fire now using the brand new American short-delay fuses from misdropped French artillery shells. Within a few minutes, the rain-logged bunkers and dugouts of Weem were a complete shambles, in which the dazed survivors of 93BT and some of Weem's own Thai were frantically seeking shelter. Within a few minutes, Lieutenant Preo's tanks entered the fray, since their cannon were able to fire direct support. But the communist gunners were also prepared for them. A rain of 105 shells fell on their position, and soon tank Ratisbonne, severely disabled, fell silent. This time, Regiment 57 seemed to be determined to finish off Issevel, or at least to silence its artillery. A never-stopping rain of shells continued to hack away at the rest of the position. Friday, April 30th, 1954. The situation inside Issevel was further worsened when the garrison saw the apparent unwillingness of the Air Force transports to take chances in resupplying them. At 0200, Issevel radioed that 7 C-47 aircraft were circling over the position with only very weak flak fire to oppose them, but that they were dropping their troops in almost meaningless drivels. One plane turned back without dropping anything, a second plane dropped only 4 paratroops, and all the others finally dropped only a total of 65 men, of whom only one had an accident on landing. But that was not the only trouble which faced Isabel that day. Having run out of food the previous week, it now was running out of artillery ammunition. For the last 10 days, Isabel had requested an average of 1,700 rounds of 105mm ammunition for each day, as its howitzers, part of which were now well dug in as they were firing in only one direction, took over an increasingly important part in the defense of the eastern hills of Dien Bien Phu. Yet it had received only an average of 348 rounds every 24 hours. De Castri now requested that Hanoi build up a reserve of 8,000 rounds of ammunition on Isabel, a more so as flak was relatively thinner near the southern strongpoint than around the main center of resistance at Dien Bien Phu. With a point of irony, De Castries conceded that this will involve a few risks for the transport aviation, but our situation here requires that they too assume some risks. April 30th was also the traditional holiday of the Foreign Legion, Camarone. On that day in 1863, a small Foreign Legion company had, in a manner reminiscent of the Alamo, fought to the death at the Mexican Hacienda de Camarone, in order to cover the retreat to the coast of the French forces which had come to Mexico to prop up Austrian-born Emperor Maximilian. The ceremonial involves a reading of an account of the battle by the youngest legionnaire, a festive dinner, and an induction to honorary membership in the Foreign Legion of particularly well-liked non-legionnaires. Tradition was not broken on Isabel. With the whole position constantly under fire since the previous day, and with Strongpoint Wien breached in 3 places, Camarone Day was properly celebrated. Colonel Lalande himself sang the traditional Foreign Legion song, Tiens voilà du boudin, and the 2 clergymen at Isabel, Reverend Pierre Tissot and Father Guidon, were made honorary privates first class in the Foreign Legion. Tissot was the only Protestant minister in all of Dien Bien Phu, and was at Isabel by accident when it became impossible to reopen the road to the main position. Guidon had been a missionary with the Thai tribesmen at Lai Chau, and in December 1953 had trekked to Dien Bien Phu with them, and also had become immobilized on Isabel when it was surrounded. He went to the prison camps with the garrison, and shared its fate to the end. Undaunted, he returned to missionary work later, and in 1959 I met him in northeastern Thailand at Ubon Rajthani, still spreading the gospel. Saturday to Monday, May 1st to 3rd, 1954. With the major attack now underway on the main position, the communists now were also accentuating the pressure on Isabel. During the night of May 1st, they achieved their first real breakthrough in the northeastern corner of Wien. On the other hand, the legionnaires on the western side sallied forth to fill in communist trenches and reached a point 200 meters northwest of Isabel, where they made a strange discovery: a dead African in communist uniform. Since he had no identification papers on him, it was impossible to tell whether he was a turncoat French African soldier taken prisoner by the communists, or whether he was a Chinese-trained volunteer. In the meantime, however, the communist attack on Wien continued. At 0200 of May 2nd, Regiment 57 succeeded in gaining a foothold in the position, now defended by 11th Company 33 REI, the Algerians, and 2 tanks. At 0830, the French could count 100 Viet Minh bodies in the barbed wire. By noon, only 6 of the original 11 howitzers were still firing. At 1220, the French again counterattacked on Wien, but were stopped once more, but a third counterattack at 1610 finally got a foothold. What was left of Strongpoint Wien was just an incredible quagmire of rotting bodies, destroyed ordnance, and shell craters. There was no recognizable position. Lalande decided to leave an alert patrol on it, but not to attempt to garrison it. At 2400, communist artillery shells again began to rain on martyred Wien. The survivors of the patrol began to fall back. The day had cost the French 5 killed, 1 missing, and 22 wounded. On the following day, the Foreign Legion again fought its way through the barbed wire on the western flank into the communist forward trenches, which had to be cleared in hand-to-hand combat. The legionnaires counted 8 communist dead and wounded many others, and brought back with them 19 submachine guns and 2 rifles. On Wien, the patrol captured a communist 75mm recoilless rifle. If anything, these last operations tend to show that, contrary to some accounts, isolated Isabel did not accept its ultimate fate passively. Tuesday to Thursday, May 4th to 6th, 1954. Despite the never-ending bombardment, in which some 75mm pack howitzers now also participated, the foreign legionnaires mounted another operation on the Viet Minh trench system west of Isabel in the midst of a monsoon storm. This time, however, they fell upon an enemy ready and waiting for them. When the legionnaires finally fell back late at night, they had lost 2 dead and 30 wounded, including 2 of their officers. On that day also, Reverend Tissot was wounded by communist shell fragments. On May 5th, Lalande received a top-secret message informing him of the contemplated breakout operation codenamed Albatross. As will be seen later, the plan involved a breakout southward into Laos via Isabel, with the latter having to play for a few hours the unenviable role of a holding position and rear guard. I was told later that Lalande felt that to communicate the plan to the troops, or even the subordinate commanders, might have a demoralizing effect. He decided to keep it to himself for the time being, with the result that when he and his own troops were left to attempt Albatross by themselves, they had to do it without any rehearsal. On May 6th, Isabel disappeared under a permanent cloud of exploding mud. Communist batteries, intent on neutralizing what last help Libye's howitzers could give to the main position, maintained a steady bombardment of the whole strongpoint. Wiem had given, become no man's land, but Isabel's garrison could take a small measure of pride in the fact that to the end, no Viet Minh unit ever succeeded in permanently holding on to a shred of the strongpoint. At 2200, a succession of heavy explosions shattered Isabel as communist shells found their mark, and 3 of the remaining 105s were destroyed with their ammunition and crews. By midnight, there remained but one last howitzer on the position. 3rd Battalion, 10th Colonial Artillery, had done its duty to the end. Friday, May 7th, 1954. Throughout the night of May 6 to 7, the enemy artillery bombardment never let up on Isabel. By listening to the radio traffic, Isabel also realized that Dien Bien Phu was dying. By early afternoon of May 7th, Lalande and his men could watch the explosions and fires of the depots on Dien Bien Phu, and around 4 o'clock, Lalande received a radio call from de Castries. With Lalande having served with the Free French forces alongside the British 8th Army in Egypt, both men could easily converse in English for greater secrecy. De Castries told Lalande, "I'm afraid I'll have to give up. You are now free to try Albatross." De Castries also told Lalande that, instead of attempting to break out to the southwest, which seemingly was the shortest distance to friendly forces, but where communist roadblocks would most likely await them, Lalande's troops should attempt to break out toward the southeast. Since that direction pointed deep into enemy territory, it was likely to be less well guarded. Also, small French and mountain tribal commando groups of the GCMA, operating far ahead of the Condor relief force of Colonel Boucher de Crèvecoeur, had cautiously worked their way to the very edge of the southern end of the valley. Very cautiously, their radio transmitter had made contact with Isabel's command channel, and now that the communist siege ring had become airtight, Lalande ordered Lieutenant Wiem and his Thai partisans to revert to their traditional role and attempt to break out in the direction of the French commando force, codenamed Condor. From its vantage point in the hills near Ban Cong, the commando force could see Isabel quite clearly. As one of the survivors of the lone southern strongpoint would say later, the defense of Isabel had been hell in a very small place. 9. Vulture, Condor, and Albatross. The agony of Dien Bien Phu was to become the object of an international disagreement between France, the United States, and Great Britain, the repercussions of which still make themselves felt more than a decade later. On the communist side, Dien Bien Phu represents the kind of military victory which has widespread political effect. On the western side, Dien Bien Phu, to the French, represents an extreme of American indecision and British callousness. In the United States, which in 1966 is deeply committed to ensuring the survival of the Republic of South Vietnam, the ghost of Dien Bien Phu still haunts the minds of military and political planners. What remains important to this day is the byplay which led to the failure of Allied action to stave off French defeat at Dien Bien Phu. Here, American actions in Vietnam since the deliberate bombardment of North Vietnamese territory as of February 8, 1965, eloquently show that some conclusions have been drawn from the previous experience. Precisely because the political byplay which took place in those tragic days of spring 1954 still has relevance today for the United States, it is difficult to obtain from American official sources a coherent picture of what exactly went on. Fortunately, French and British sources no longer are bound by such restrictions. Several high officials of both countries, such as Britain's then Foreign Secretary Sir Anthony Eden and France's then Prime Minister Joseph Laniel, among others, have published accounts which are substantially in accord with each other as to the sequence of events. In the United States, the volume of memoirs published by President Eisenhower and certain press articles whose correctness were not denied by the late Secretary of State John Foster Dulles also contribute to the overall picture. In American foreign policy, the fates of Korea and Indochina were considered as intimately linked from the date of the outbreak of the Korean War in June 1950 to the end of the Truman administration in January 1953. This common concept of policies included as one of its basic tenets that none of the Western powers engaged in military operations against a communist aggressor would negotiate a separate ceasefire, since the immediate results would be an increased burden upon the others' theaters of operations. The quid pro quo of that agreement was that the French broke off negotiations underway with the Viet Minh, while the United States began to assume an ever-increasing part of the financial burden of the Indochina War. The closeness of the relationship between the Indochina and Korean Wars becomes really clear when it is remembered that the 1954 Geneva Conference, though it dealt almost exclusively with Indochina, was still officially billed as a conference to settle both the Korean and the Indochina problem. In actual fact, however, the administration of Dwight D. Eisenhower felt it important to honor its commitment to the American electorate to settle the costly Korean stalemate by some sort of a ceasefire. When the communist powers agreed to an arrangement under the terms of which the two Koreas would remain divided at a battle line which more or less straddled the original 38th parallel, the administration accepted, and the ceasefire was signed on July 27, 1953. The record does not as yet show whether the French government of the time made a strong effort either to prevent a unilateral ceasefire in Korea or to make it dependent upon similar indications of goodwill on the part of the communists in Vietnam. But the then Prime Minister makes it clear in his book on the subject that he informed Navarre personally at the July 24, 1953 session of the French National Defense Committee, the equivalent of the American National Security Council, that the French government intended to begin negotiations for a ceasefire as soon as that in Korea was signed. In any case, as I know from personal experience since I was in Hanoi during all of the summer of 1953, the increased weight of new materiel for the communists and of Chinese instructors for the Viet Minh forces made itself readily felt immediately after the Korean ceasefire. This cause-and-effect relationship between the end of the Korean War and the increase of the war burden on Indochina is readily acknowledged by President Eisenhower. Toward the end of 1953, the effect of the termination of hostilities in Korea began to be felt in Indochina. The Chinese communists now were able to spare greatly increased quantities of materiel in the form of guns and ammunition, largely supplied by the Soviets, for use on the Indochinese battlefront. More advisers were being sent in, and the Chinese were making available to the Viet Minh logistical experience they had gained in the Korean War. Other contemporary American sources make it clear that this consequence of the Korean ceasefire had been clearly realized at the time, but it apparently was felt that the risk could be undertaken. The principal negotiator in Korea, Arthur Dean, who also had been a law partner of John Foster Dulles, testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in January 1957 that it was known in advance that a Korean truce would release Chinese troops to attack French Indochina. When asked by the then Senator Hubert Humphrey if it was his impression that the communists had accepted an armistice in Korea in order to be free to move into Indochina, Dean replied that this was his opinion and went on to say that in June 1953, the administration had sent Lieutenant General John W. O'Daniel, then commander of U.S. Army forces in the Pacific, to make a survey of the situation in Indochina, and that he had returned from his mission with the view that the French could withstand the pressure with increased American aid. As in the case of Dien Bien Phu itself, General O'Daniel's optimism was not justified by later events. In the absence of any documentation from the communist side, it is difficult to state whether Moscow, Peking, then still tightly aligned with it, and the Viet Minh in the jungle took the unilateral Korean ceasefire as a signal that direct American help to the French, should the Indochina situation deteriorate further, would be anything but assured. On the other hand, with the United States extricated from a military confrontation with communism under conditions which could be criticized, and were, by right-wing elements, as appeasement, the Eisenhower administration no longer was particularly interested in fostering yet another situation in Indochina which could only lead to yet another accommodation with communism on a basis that fell far short of a victory. This view led, in the fall of 1953, to a considerable hardening of the American position toward negotiation in Indochina. The immediate result of that new position was a considerable relaxation of pressure on France to grant or complete the granting of independence to the Indochina states, the granting of an additional $385 million to France for the specific purpose of implementing the Navarre Plan, and an exchange of letters on September 29, 1953, which provided for greater consultation between the two governments with regard to Indochina that was interpreted in the French Parliament to mean that France could not negotiate an Indochina ceasefire with the Viet Minh or Peking without prior American approval. In France itself, the new American encouragement to seek an improved military situation prior to negotiations was well received by the conservative coalition which then was in control of the French government. An offer made by Ho Chi Minh via Sweden on November 29, 1953, that is, hardly a week after the first French landing at Dien Bien Phu, of direct negotiations with France, based on a simple battlefield truce, was never given an official answer. Throughout the winter of 1953-54, little transpired that would make Paris or Washington adopt a different reading of the situation. According to his own memoirs, President Eisenhower still felt in January 1954 that United States ground forces would not be required in Southeast Asia, and that American airstrikes in support of the French against communist forces deployed in the jungle would be of little effectiveness, and, in his words, would create a double jeopardy. It would comprise an act of war, and would also entail the risk of having intervened and lost. In any case, such American support was, for the time being, considered a mere hypothesis. As was shown earlier, American military observers, in whom the president had the greatest personal trust, readily discounted the pessimistic statements made even by the French senior officials, who were in the best position to know how their military were faring in Indochina. How badly misinformed the administration in Washington was became clear after the first attacks on Dien Bien Phu. Even a decade later, Eisenhower still wondered about the pessimism displayed by the French after the fall of strongpoints Beatrice and Gabriel, since in his view, the French, well dug in, should have had no trouble in fending off even a more numerous attacking force. Apparently, General O'Daniel had failed to see, or failed to report, the obvious deficiencies of the Dien Bien Phu position, aside from its valley-bottom location. But there was yet another problem that deeply worried the French. What if the Chinese threw their air force into the fight? Over the previous 2 years, French intelligence had reported the presence of several Chinese airfields in the proximity of the North Vietnamese border. The then-modern MiG-15s had been spotted on those airfields, and some of them assuredly bore Viet Minh rather than Chinese insignia. During the earlier Kien Park conferences, the possibility of a Chinese-Korean-type attack against the French in Indochina had been taken under consideration, and the French had worked out a contingency plan, fittingly codenamed Damocles, which provided for the immediate falling back of all French forces in North Indochina to a beachhead position in the Red River Delta, and to the occupation of a defensive line across the narrow waist of the Indochina Peninsula until American and other Allied forces would become available. Damocles also provided for the immediate intervention of United States air power over Indochina. As will be seen, during the following few weeks, Secretary of State Dulles, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the then Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Arthur B. Radford, would use every means at their command to show that the conditions for unleashing Damocles had indeed occurred in Indochina, and particularly in the Valley of Dien Bien Phu. A 3-week mission of investigation in Indochina by the French Minister of Defense, René Plevin, merely reinforced the pessimism of the French government. In the course of a meeting of the French National Defense Committee on March 11, 1954, Plevin informed the Prime Minister that in order to avoid any misunderstanding with the United States, which in his words still seemed to count on the possibility of a fairly rapid military solution, he would send the chairman of the French Joint Chiefs, General Paul Elie, to Washington. General Elie had previously served in Washington as the senior French representative to the NATO Standing Group and was known for his feelings of friendship for the United States, and thus was a good choice for that mission, save for the fact that his understanding of the English language was somewhat limited. When Elie arrived in Washington on March 20th, Hill's Beatrice and Gabriel had fallen after a brief struggle, and Almeries 1 and 2 had been abandoned 3 days earlier by the 3rd BT. Dien Bien Phu's airfield was under heavy fire, and the evacuation of casualties was in jeopardy when Elie began his conversations with Secretary Dulles, his brother, Alan Dulles, then director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Vice President Nixon, and General Matthew Ridgway, Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army. Elie also saw President Eisenhower and, a rare privilege for a foreign officer, attended a meeting of the U.S. Joint Chiefs. When John Foster Dulles saw Elie again on Tuesday, March 23rd, for a formal working session at the State Department, he prudently did not commit the United States to any support action on behalf of the French. Two versions of the key points that were discussed are available. According to a memorandum prepared by Dulles for President Eisenhower, Dulles told Elie that the United States could not afford to engage its prestige in a military operation and suffer a defeat which would have worldwide repercussions. According to Elie, a possibility of American intervention in Indochina had been directly raised, but, says Elie, and I insisted on this point, would become conceivable only in the hypothesis of Chinese air action in Indochina. But while Elie was in the United States, the Viet Minh at Dien Bien Phu unveiled its new powerful artillery, and above all, its Chinese anti-aircraft batteries. Contrary to expectations, then, the Chinese intervention took on not the aspect of airstrikes, but of a fairly massive specialized support on the ground, for which the contingency plans of the old Damocles project had no answer. It became readily foreseeable that the Chinese flak would bring disaster to Dien Bien Phu just as readily as Chinese MiGs. In the light of this new situation, Radford, who already had, in previous conversations with Elie, suggested to the latter that American military intervention would be feasible if the French government formally requested it, now proposed to Elie the possibility of brief American action against the communist flak positions. In Radford's view, this would merely be, to use a term much in vogue at present, a matching escalation for that undertaken by the Chinese in providing North Vietnam with abundant artillery and logistical support. Here again, Elie insists that the initiative came from Admiral Radford. Elie had barely arrived in Paris on March 27th when Secretary Dulles, on March 29th, delivered a major address on Asian policy before the Overseas Press Club in New York City. In language still used in 1966 to explain the American position in South Vietnam, Dulles first ticked off the details of Chinese communist involvement with the Viet Minh, thereby compromising, according to the French, some highly precious French intelligence networks in the communist-held areas of Vietnam. Then the Secretary of State went on to warn that the imposition on Southeast Asia of communism should be met by united action. This might involve serious risks, but these risks are far less than those that will face us a few years from now if we dare not be resolute today. Dulles also recalled that on March 24th, President Eisenhower had stated that Southwest Asia was of transcendent importance to the free world. The speech, which was billed as having the advance approval of President Eisenhower, was received in Paris with considerable elation. Prime Minister Laniel, who, in the meantime, had organized a special restricted war committee to decide on Indochina policy, made up of the Joint Chiefs and some key cabinet members, met with Elie and the committee on March 29th to debate what appeared to be a firm American offer. To the French, while tempting, the offer was not an undisguised blessing. What would happen if a single such American raid, or even a series, failed to destroy the Viet Minh siege force, but, on the other hand, brought in its wake a massive Chinese intervention of the Korean type, beginning with swarms of MiG fighters? Or, if such a raid brought in its wake the destruction of all hopes of a peaceful solution to the Indochina War at Geneva on April 26th, should the communist powers decide to withdraw from the conference. Having scraped by several close calls in Parliament on the Indochina problem, the broadening of the war created by American intervention might cause the defection from Laniel's coalition of the left-of-center parties it needed to remain in power. Laniel and the War Committee decided to send Colonel Brouin, an aide of Ailly, who had been with him in Washington and had attended all the crucial conferences, to Saigon in order to sound out Navarre as to whether he felt that Dien Bien Phu's situation was such that all risks had to be taken to save its garrison. When Brouin finally caught up with Navarre in Hanoi on April 2nd, the first battle for the Five Hills had just taken a disastrous turn, which only a massive annihilation of the enemy flak could reverse. Two equally authoritative French versions exist of the next act of the drama. According to Colonel Jules Rat, whose account is based on General Cogny's recollection of the event, Brouin mentioned that the project involved the use of several A-bombs in the Dien Bien Phu area. According to Major Jean Puget, who then was Navarre's personal aide, the question of the use of atomic weapons was never raised, even under a veiled form. A similar discrepancy exists as to Navarre's answer. According to Rat, the answer was negative. Puget, on the other hand, cites the full text of Navarre's reply to Ailly sent by radio message in his own personal code during the night of April 3rd to 4th. The intervention of which Colonel Brouin has spoken to me may have a decisive effect, particularly if it comes before the Viet Minh assault. Other sources confirmed that view of the facts. Since no written notes were kept of those top-secret sessions, it is not known who first gave the projected operation its eventual sinister codename, but its first written mention seems to have been in another message sent to Ailly by Navarre on April 6th. That telegram began with the simple phrase, "The planned intervention takes the codename Vulture." While the French government and the French military were trying to hammer out a common policy in Paris, Saigon, and Hanoi, John Foster Dulles and Admiral Radford simultaneously prepared the U.S. Congress for the unleashing of Vulture. On Saturday, April 3, 1954, 8 senior legislators were called to the Department of State for a secret conference with Secretary Dulles, Admiral Radford, and some of their senior aides. The legislators were a bipartisan group, including Senators Lyndon B. Johnson, then Minority Leader, Richard B. Russell, Earl C. Clements, William F. Noland, and Eugene Milliken, and representatives John W. McCormick, J. Percy Priest, and Joseph Martin. Dulles stated that President Eisenhower himself had asked him to call the meeting, and that the President wanted Congress to pass a joint resolution permitting him the use of air and naval power in Indochina. In other words, a resolution granting him a far more restricted freedom of maneuver than that which President Lyndon B. Johnson was given in August 1964. Radford then succinctly outlined the situation in Indochina, and particularly the desperate straits of Dien Bien Phu. In language which was to be used again almost verbatim a decade later, Secretary Dulles warned that the fall of Indochina might well lead to the loss of all of Southeast Asia, and that the United States might eventually be forced back to Hawaii. He also added that failure by the United States to support the French and the local governments now might result in an abandonment of the war by the French. In his outline of Vulture, Radford stated that it would be based on the two American aircraft carriers Essex and Boxer, reinforced from land-based U.S. Air Force units from Clark Field in the Philippines. According to French sources, a total of 60 B-29 heavy bombers, each carrying 9 tons of bombs, and about 450 fighter aircraft would be involved if the strike were to be made with conventional weapons. However, according to official American sources, a total of 98 heavy B-29 superfortresses, each of which carried 14 tons of bombs, with 2 wings stationed at Okinawa and 1 stationed at Clark Field, would bear the main burden of the mission. Also, close to 450 jet fighters were available to provide cover against possible forays of Chinese MiGs against the American bombers. Upon questioning, Radford allegedly stated that the action contemplated might put the United States in the war, and that, if the initial strike did not bring full relief to the fortress, follow-up strikes were contemplated. He hedged his reply as to the possibility of eventually committing American ground troops in the war, and admitted that none of the other military staff chiefs agreed in full with his plan. As is the custom, the Senate minority leader led off with the questioning of the administration representatives, and he did so with great emphasis and vigor. In fact, as the also present chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Richard B. Russell, was to recall later, the discussion was vigorous, and a bit of it might have been described as heated. According to Chalmers Roberts, Lyndon Johnson put the other key question in the form of a little speech. The Senate minority leader stated that the Korean War had been financed and fought by the United States to an extent of 90%, and then asked Dulles whether any other allied nation, outside of the French, who already were committed to the war, had been consulted as to whether they would join the United States in intervening in Vietnam. Retrospectively, this seems to have been the key question and the key stumbling point. When Dulles acknowledged that, in view of the urgency of the situation, he had not yet consulted any other allies, the 8 congressional leaders flatly turned down the idea of a joint resolution and told the administration that congressional support for Vulture or any similar operation would be contingent upon 3 conditions. 1. United States intervention must be part of a coalition to include the other free nations of Southeast Asia, the Philippines, and the British Commonwealth. 2. The French must agree to accelerate their independence program for the Indochina states so that the United States' assistance would not appear as supporting colonialism. 3. The French must agree to stay in the war. That, for all practical purposes, killed all chances of rescuing Dien Bien Phu. For it was obvious that it would be absolutely impossible to constitute anything resembling a united front of Allied powers in sufficient time for the airstrikes to become effective. The question then arises whether the subsequent activities of Secretary Dulles to establish such a front were simply an attempt to shift the blame on other hesitant allies, such as the British, a view that was openly expressed later, or whether he in fact believed that such a united action, even if it failed to materialize in time to save Dien Bien Phu, might still come in handy for a subsequent American intervention in the war, or as a diplomatic backstop for the coming Geneva conference. In the absence of any published American documentation on the subject, it is difficult today to assess whether that second alternative was then considered an acceptable fallback position. The available testimony of all the French participants clearly shows that only the first alternative, that is, the rescue of hard-pressed Dien Bien Phu, was first and foremost in their minds, and that they were not particularly interested in the second alternative, which, even if successful, could only ensure the failure of the Geneva Conference and an extension in time, or perhaps in scope, of the Indochina War. During the same weekend, Colonel Brouin was on his way back from Indochina to Paris. He arrived on Sunday, April 4th, and he immediately spoke to General Ely. He expressed to him the second thoughts which Navarre harbored about Vulture, notably that it might lead to an unleashing of Red China, but at that very moment, Navarre's top-secret telegram requesting U.S. intervention arrived in Ely's hands. Armed with the telegram and reinforced by Brouin's presence, Ely went to see the defense minister, Plevin, and the latter took both of them directly to the prime minister. Laniel, in turn, decided to call a meeting of the War Committee for after dinner. In a dramatic late-evening session, fully conscious that their decision might bring about an expansion of the war and a shattering of all hopes of a détente with the Soviet bloc, the War Committee decided to make a formal request for U.S. air intervention in the war. At midnight, Laniel requested that the United States Ambassador in Paris, Douglas Dillon, come to see him immediately at Matignon, the official residence of the Prime Minister. At 0100 of April 5th, or at about the same time, making allowance for the differences in time zones, as the French at Dien Bien Phu retook Huguette 6, the French Prime Minister explained the gravity of the situation at Dien Bien Phu to the American ambassador. He underlined that only American heavy bombers could destroy the deeply dug-in Viet Minh artillery in the hills around Dien Bien Phu, and that only such an operation could still save the garrison. While the American ambassador transmitted the telegram via his own channels to Washington, Ely also informed his own successor at the NATO Standing Group in the Pentagon, General Valois, of the decision made in order to accelerate to the utmost the military measures about to be undertaken by Admiral Radford. According to Ely, Valois telephoned him from Washington early in the afternoon, Paris time, that is, in the forenoon, Washington time, that matters were progressing satisfactorily with the American military. At the same time, the French embassy in Washington again reported that obviously inspired press releases and unattributed statements mentioned heavy Chinese intervention in Vietnam and seemed to be preparing American public and congressional opinion for an American intervention at Dien Bien Phu. On the same day also, President Eisenhower wrote a long personal letter to Winston Churchill, who, though 85, had again assumed the prime ministership of his country. In his letter, largely made public in the president's first volume of memoirs, Eisenhower outlined to Churchill the new United Front concept. The important thing is that the coalition must be strong, and it must be willing to join the fight if necessary. I do not envisage the need of any appreciable ground forces on your or our part. If I may refer again to history, we failed to halt Hirohito, Mussolini, and Hitler by not acting in unity and in time. That marked the beginning of many years of stark tragedy and desperate peril. May it not be that our nations have learned something from that lesson? With warm regards, Ike. As is now known from the memoirs of Britain's then Foreign Secretary, Sir Anthony Eden, the American request was received with consternation. Sir Winston and British public opinion were, after almost 7 years of Cold War, dead set against any move which could jeopardize the prospects of the forthcoming Geneva Conference. Hence, Churchill took 3 days to reply to his good wartime friend, and his reply was simply that the British government would discuss the matter with Dulles in London on April 12th. 2 days after its formal launching, the Dulles-Radford plan already was encountering heavy resistance on several key fronts. It is difficult to assess from the available records how long it took the French to become aware of the fact that Operation Vulture, as originally planned, was already in serious jeopardy. It must have been almost immediately after the telephone conversation between Valois and Elie, because on April 7th, Navarre replied negatively to a message from General Elie asking him whether he would accept the use of 15 B-29 heavy bombers to be operated out of Clark Field with French Air Force crews from Indochina. Navarre's refusal to accept the B-29s on that basis rested on at least 3 serious objections. First, there was a desperate shortage of air crews in the Indochina theater. There were more aircraft available than French pilots to fly them, and it would take France a month to replace the 30 multi-engine pilots who would be going to Manila. To deprive the already overburdened Dien Bien Phu airlift of 30 air crews would have been disastrous. Second, American estimates were that it would take even trained multi-engine pilots 4 months to become completely familiarized with the B-29s. By then, the fate of Dien Bien Phu would have long been sealed, and the whole project would have been largely irrelevant. Third, the sudden appearance of such a small heavy bomber force with French insignia but without the requisite heavy fighter escort would have been an open invitation for the Chinese to score an easy victory by sending in a force of Chinese MiGs to shoot them down, thus precipitating Operation Damocles, but without any assurance of American support. It is difficult to assess how far the plans for this particular subvariant of Vulture were pushed. I was told, however, that B-29s with French tricolor bullseye insignia could be seen standing ready at Clark Field. That the French were short on multi-engine pilots was as much their own fault as that of NATO planning. Since France had been assigned within the alliance a wholly defensive role in the field of aviation, French pilots were entirely trained for fighter-interceptor missions. In fact, a separate French bomber command did not even exist at the time of Dien Bien Phu, and during World War II, the United States provided the Free French with no combat aircraft larger than the twin-engine B-26. The same problem arose in the field of air transport. Since NATO plans did not provide for a French role in that field, French Air Force tactical transport was reduced to a minimum. The net result of all of this was that, aside from the already committed French Navy privateer bomber crews, there was no French personnel available to man the B-29. By the time the Battle of Dien Bien Phu ended, there were in all of France only 40 twin-engine transport crews left in reserve. It is unofficially admitted by the French that they had misinformed the United States about the state of readiness of French flying personnel. At Dien Bien Phu, the consequences of that lack of candor now were there for everyone to see. Realistically, Navarre understood that it would be folly to assume that Vulture, in one form or another, would be launched in the near future. Also, as has been seen, Navarre that very day began to undertake the planning for a diversionary operation against the communist siege ring on the basis of a small Thai-pronged relief force from Laos, of which more will be said later. The code name for that undertaking, in order to remain consistent with the bird motif chosen earlier for the raids on Dien Bien Phu, was Condor. But while Washington apparently had written off Vulture, the American planners in the field were going ahead in the full belief that the mission to rescue the French would be executed. At the beginning of April 1954, Lieutenant General Earl E. Pat Partridge, commander of the U.S. Far Eastern Air Force, FEAF, had arrived in Saigon and begun talks with his French counterpart, General Lauzun, as well as with Navarre. He had brought with him Brigadier General Joseph D. Caldara, then the chief of the FEAF Bomber Command, the man who would fly and command the Vulture missions. The Americans had arrived at Saigon's Thong Son Nhut Airport in a discreet B-17 so as not to alert hostile eyes to the unfamiliar configuration of the B-29 Superforts. From the beginning, the Americans were appalled at the total lack of French preparedness for anything like the control of a major saturation bombardment operation. For instance, Caldara soon found that there was not, in all of Indochina, short-range navigational radar, SHORAN, equipment, which was absolutely essential to precision guidance of heavy bombers which were supposed to hit an enemy closely encircling a friendly force. A hesitation of a few seconds, a minute guidance error, and hundreds of tons of explosive bombs would obliterate the French rather than the Viet Minh. Caldara decided to judge the situation for himself. On April 4, 1954, in the dead of the night, he flew his B-17 with an American crew over the valley of Dien Bien Phu, repeated the mission later with the French Dakota, and then once more with the B-17. In Hanoi, where he had met Cogny and Deschaux and found them very eager to see Vulture attempted, Cogny had suggested that 3 SHORAN ground parties could be parachuted into the jungle to guide the bombers, even if they had to be sacrificed. The Americans, however, felt that there were too many elements of chance involved in that approach. Instead, Caldara proposed contour flying and bombardment by visual navigation, even if this entailed greater risks for the American air crews. Otherwise, the overall plan was simple enough. The 2 wings from Okinawa and the 1 from Clark would rendezvous east of the Laotian capital of Vientiane, head for their target, and exit from Indochina via the Gulf of Tonkin. Strict orders were given that any disabled superfort would do its utmost to crash in the open sea, rather than on the ground, where communist discovery of B-29s, and worse, of live American aircrews, could have appalling political repercussions. Meanwhile, as the French began to realize that their American opposite numbers were stalling for time until Washington made up its mind, exchanges became more acrimonious, not only between the French and the Americans, but also between the American air commanders and their own diplomats on the spot, since the latter fully realized the implications of a French defeat at Dien Bien Phu. When FEAF made known its requirements for ground-based SHORAN, the Saigon mission let it be known that it was disappointed to find that the Strategic Air Command, SAC, was not an all-weather force. The French themselves, at the highest political levels, seemed to have no idea of the awful destructive power of 98 superforts, and suggested that, if need be, the chances of killing some of the French defenders of Dien Bien Phu should not prevent the raid from taking place. Banging with his fist on the table, one of the American generals reminded his colleagues that saturation missions were not flown on that basis. The American chargé d'affaires, Robert McClintock, sought to lighten the atmosphere by citing George Clemenceau's famous phrase that perhaps war was too serious a business to be left entirely to generals. But this was no longer a time for jokes. General Caldara wheeled around, looked at McClintock, and said quietly, "If that mission takes place, I'm going to be riding the lead B-29 into the goddamn flak, and you're welcome to the right seat." On April 8th, Dulles finally informed the French that no American action on behalf of Dien Bien Phu could be undertaken without some sort of common Western position. That, of course, shifted the burden of decision from the American executive to the Allies, particularly the British. Eden's memoirs appear to make it clear that Britain was in no way willing to make even a token gesture that would lead the Red Chinese to believe that London was ready to support an American-French allied military undertaking before Geneva. Yet Secretary Dulles, to judge from Eisenhower's recollection, informed the President that he had succeeded in overcoming most of Britain's objections to joint action. That was, to say the least, a total misreading of the British position, but there is no doubt that upon continuing his journey from London to Paris on April 14th, Dulles conveyed a similar reading to his French partners, Prime Minister Laniel, and the radically activist French Foreign Minister, Georges Bidault. Bidault, an ardent advocate of keeping Algeria French, later conspired against de Gaulle, and now lives in exile in Latin America. It is in the course of that particular meeting that Dulles allegedly brought up the subject of using atomic bombs to save the French garrison at Dien Bien Phu. According to one extremely well-informed source, whose statement, when published, was never officially denied, Dulles said to Bidault in French, "And if we gave you two atomic bombs to save Dien Bien Phu?" It should be underlined that Dulles, who had in his youth studied at the Sorbonne, spoke good French, and that Bidault had, prior to entering politics, been a professor of English. Hence, the chances that either of them had misunderstood the other were minimal. Bidault was said to have replied that the use of such bombs would destroy the garrison as well as the Viet Minh, and General Ely, though denying that the use of A-bombs had ever been seriously considered, nonetheless spoke of the presence of the nuclear deterrent represented by the aircraft carriers of the 7th Fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin. It is perhaps immaterial at this point whether such a use of atomic weapons around Dien Bien Phu was feasible or even desirable, and this writer, for one, on the basis of his personal research, is certain that their use had been seriously considered at one point or another by the military planners involved. But the fact remains that even British Foreign Secretary Eden seems to have been persuaded that the use of such weapons was not entirely ruled out and that the weapons were readily available for use. Further circumstantial evidence to that effect was provided by the French Prime Minister in a parliamentary debate on May 4, 1954, just before the fall of Dien Bien Phu, when he stated that in previous military conversations with our allies, all solutions susceptible to improve a situation such as that of Dien Bien Phu had been studied. But he added, seemingly as an ominous afterthought, that those solutions which, prior to the Geneva Conference, included the risk of generalizing the conflict, had been rejected. When the garrison at Dien Bien Phu, contrary to all expectations, managed to survive the battles for the Five Hills and the first battle for the Huguettes, Giap ordered new supplies from China. Thus, the problem of bombing the communist rear supply lines, rather than Dien Bien Phu, again came to the fore. Now, contrary to what he had said 10 days earlier, Navarre would have been glad to get 15 to 20 B-29s for the purpose of bombing Road 41 between the Red River and the main Viet Minh supply point at Tuan Jiao, northeast of Dien Bien Phu. But now, with Britain hanging back, that alternative no longer seemed to be available either. A brief message from Ely to Navarre noted, "Radford rejects that solution. Everything or nothing." But while Dulles was still discussing Vulture with the French leaders in Paris, the commander of the United States Far Eastern Air Force, General Partridge, arrived in Saigon. His conversations with the French High Commissioner, Maurice de Jean, and Navarre revived their hope that American intervention in one form or another was still not altogether excluded. But the rest of the week, as the Battle of Dien Bien Phu hung in the balance, and as communist morale was at its lowest, and the morale of the French garrison found a viable equilibrium, turned out to be a dead loss for Vulture. Dulles, still acting under the mistaken belief that he had a British commitment for support in his pocket, had called a meeting on April 20th in Washington of the ambassadors of Australia, Britain, Cambodia, France, Laos, New Zealand, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam for the purpose of setting up the machinery for united action. Churchill and Eden, unwilling, as the latter termed it, to endorse a bad policy for the sake of unity, this time stood unequivocally firm. They directed their ambassador in Washington, Sir Roger Makins, not to attend the meeting. That boycott killed the conference. The bitterness and despair of the French government in Paris, caught between the ever more pressing SOS messages from Indochina and the American roller coaster of promises and denials, became profound. Arriving in Paris for a NATO ministerial meeting, which was to begin on April 23rd, Dulles had ample occasion to see his French colleagues in private, since he was to stay there for 3 days, until the Geneva Conference began on April 26th. According to a message sent to Eisenhower by Dulles on April 23rd at 20:00, Bidault had reached a point of nervous breakdown and incoherence. With the conference at Geneva beginning in a few days, it became clear that the communists in Vietnam were attempting to finish off the battered fortress so as to deliver its defeat as an opener to their side at Geneva. Hence, any prolongation of its survival to a point in time where at least a temporary ceasefire could be effected in Indochina would be, the French felt, an immense gain. Accordingly, they literally begged Dulles to press for the implementation of Bulcher. Under firm instructions from Eisenhower, Dulles now held his ground. There would be no American bombing operation near Dien Bien Phu which did not meet the requirement of the mandate of the congressional leaders of April 3rd, American air action only within the framework of an Allied force, and only after debating and voting on the proposed joint resolution. Perhaps without realizing it, Lyndon B. Johnson, on April 3, 1954, had made his first crucial decision on Vietnam. By the